Alright, so the question is, what's going to happen when the face is going to be clicked? So the script is, when face is clicked, you set n to 0, then you change n by 1, and you broadcast feeling, and wait. And then you say, and you, for 2 seconds. When you receive feeling, so what feeling does is, you say, I'm feeling, for 2 seconds. Then if n equals 0, you say sad. If n equals 1, you say okay. If n equals 2, you say great. And if n is smaller than 2, you say could be better. So that the last one is n is smaller than 2. So what's this going to say? Is it going to say A, and you, I'm feeling sad, okay, great, could be better. B, I'm feeling okay, and you? C, I'm feeling could be better. D, I'm feeling okay, could be better, and you? E, I'm feeling sad, could be better, and you? Stop at 1:45. Stopping? Nice. Okay. So what happened? In this script. N is set to 0, but then it's set to 1 right away. So as the subroutine feeling is broadcasted, N is 1. So then the subroutine says when I receive feeling, if N equals 0, it's not. If N equals 1, say okay. So I'm feeling. Then it tests the n, it determines that it's equal to 1, say okay. Then, is it equal to 2? It's not. Is it smaller than 2? It is. Would be better. And then, it finishes the subroutine, it goes back to the beginning, or after feeling, and asks, okay. Any questions? No. All right. We've done a few of these last time. This is the halting problem, right? Trying to determine for what values of question mark will the script eventually halt. So the script is when the sprite is clicked, you set count to question mark. You repeat until count is smaller than 64. And what you do in the repeat is you play the sounds and you set count to count times 2. And after the repeat until, you say done. So for what values will the cat eventually say done? And the options are A, all values smaller than 64. B, all positive values. C, all positive powers of 2 smaller than 64. D, all values larger than 64. And E, no values. Thank you. I'll stop at 2. Stopping in 5? Stopping? All values smaller than 64. Alright. So let's do this one. Okay, so we said that the way to approach this problem is to try to look around 64. Try to look around the values in the repeat until loop. So we're going to take 64 and we're going to say, okay, what happens for anything that's smaller than 64? Well, let's say 63. Anything that's smaller than 64 fulfills the condition, which will it's not even going to go into the loop, right? So anything that's smaller than 64 stops right away. So those values are except 64. No, not 64 is not in the. So right, you stop right before 64, and this is good. These are all good. If anything is bigger than 64, let's see what happens for 64. If count starts by being 64, it says repeat until count is smaller than 64, which it isn't. So it goes into the loop, and it makes it count was 64, it makes it, what's the next value? What does it say? It says count is count times 2. So the next number is 128. Is 128 smaller than 64? No. Continues in the loop, it makes it, what's the next value? And so on. And this is not going to be able to reach 64, but be smaller than 64 if it continues going this way. So all values smaller than 64 is the right answer. Any questions? Alright, second one. This time, the only thing that changes is repeating until count is larger than 64. So it's strictly bigger than 64. And options are A, all values, B, all positive values, C, all positive values of 2 smaller than 64, D, all values larger than 64, and E, no values. Stopping in at 140? 5? Stopping? Okay, the battle is between all positive values and all values larger than 64. Okay, so I'll start with D. What happens for all values that are larger than 64? Can you tell me what happens? Yeah.
It already stops because it doesn't need to go into the loop.
Right. So it stops right away because it doesn't even need to go into the loop. The condition is met. So those are good. Those are definitely good. Alright. Now what happens to something that's smaller to 64? it, so it stops. So it looks like 63 works. What about 1? Does 1 work? 1 works, right? Because it's not greater than 64, but it makes it 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and then it's 128, and then it stops. What happens for 0? Does it stop for 0?
No.
Why not?
Because 0 times 2 will always be 0, and any negative number will just become more negative.
Alright, so if it's 0, it's going through the loop, and it's making a count times 2. Count times 2 is 0. It goes into the loop, it makes it times 2, 0, 0, 0. So it's always going to be 0. If it's something negative, minus 1 becomes minus 2, minus 4, minus 8, and so on, and it's never going to be able to reach 64. So the right answer is all positive values. Because all values that are bigger than 64 are good, and then everything that's positive is going to eventually, if you multiply by 2, it's going to eventually hit 64, and then you're done, and it stops. Any questions? Okay. Third one. This is, I replaced the bigger than 64 with equal to 64. And options are A, all integer values, B, all positive values smaller than 64, C, all positive powers of 2 smaller than 64, D, all values larger than 64, and E, no values. Stopping at 125. 3 more seconds. Stopping. All right. Nice. So, the point when it's equal, it needs to hit exactly 64. So, does anything here have a chance? No, because you multiply by 2 and it's never going to be exactly equal to 64. So anything a little bigger than 64. Okay. Does anything here have a chance? Negative. No, right? Because you multiply by 2, and it's never going to hit 64, because it's going to stay at a negative number. But anything here, does anything here have a chance? Yes. What, how does that number need to be? So, do any integers work? No, right? Because let's take 63, multiply by 2, it jumps over. 12, multiply by 2 is 24, 48, and then it jumps over, 96. So it needs to be a power of 2. Like 1 works, 2 works, 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, and then multiply by 2 and you eventually get 64. So any power, positive power of 2 works. Okay? So last time we talked about Huffman codes and how we can count all the letters in a text and then we repeatedly choose the smallest frequencies, right, to make the tree. Okay, you don't have the text, but I'm giving you the frequency of all the letters in the text. This is a text that only contains V's, W's, X, Y's, and Z's. And those are your frequencies. And the question is, how many bits does it take to encode your whole text? And your options are 135, B136, C137, D138, and E139. I'll be stopping at 4. More seconds. Okay, maybe I'll give 20 more seconds. I'm stopping in 5? No? Does anybody object to stopping? All right, I'll stop. Okay, I think the majority got it right. So I'm going to do it, actually. So these are your letters, these are your frequencies, and I said that you can start by writing all the letters with their frequencies underneath. So I'm going to put them in order. I'm going to do 8 and 8, smallest frequencies. Together, combined, they make a 16. And I'm going to treat that as a separate group, a separate letter from now on. Frequency 16. My smallest ones now are cubic between 16, 10, and 12, and 24. Smallest ones are 10 and 12. So choose them. Make a 22. Now my choice of the two smallest ones is between 16, 22, and 24. Smallest ones are 16 and 22. And add it up to give me 38. And now my only choices are 24 and 38. And that gives me 62. Thank you. Alright. So I have a tree. Now I said that I'm going to label all the branches. The left branches with a 0 or the right branches with a 1. Starting at the root. So I have a 0 and a 1. At this point I have a 0 and a 1. This point I have a 0 and a 1. And at this point I have a 0 and a 1. And now to find the code for each letter, all I have to do is start at the root and try to find that letter and write down the code for the letter. So for V, all I have to do is start at the root and make a right, which is a 1. To find X, which is right here, and make a left, right, left, so 0, 1, 0. To find Z, I need to go left, 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 0, 0, 0. To find Y, I need to go left, right, 0, 0, 1. To find W, I need to go left, right, right, 0, 1. Okay. So I have a 1. One letter has a 1-bit code, and all the other letters have a 3-bit code. So now, to figure out how many bits I need, all I have to do is sum up the frequency of each letter times how many bits I need for that letter. So the number of bits is V. I have 24 Vs, 24, and each V takes up 1 bit. For the Xs, I have 10 Xs, and each X takes 3. For the Zs, 8. Each one takes 3. Y, 8, each, and each Y takes 3 bits. And then I have W, 12 Ws, and each one takes 3. So that's 24 plus 18, 26, 38, times 3, 114. Okay. Any questions? So, again, I'm going to say this again, so the codes each one of you got can be different. They don't matter. The only thing that matters is because this code is guaranteed to be the shortest code possible, everybody will get the same amount of bits. So if I'm going to ask clicker question, this is the only question I can ask. I can't ask, what's the code for Z? That's not a valid clicker question because everybody can get a different right answer for Z. Because if you do the symmetrical tree, all the zeros become ones and all the ones become zeros. The codes change, but the number of bits is always the smallest possible number. And you can't do better than that. Okay? Okay. So, I'm going to start today, talk about parallel computers, and we're going to finish it next time. So the idea is that we want to make faster computers, right? That's kind of what people have been trying to do since, 1950. So the more, it's kind of a vicious cycle, right? So the faster computers we have, the more complicated software we can run. Then we need faster computers to run that faster, and then we make more complicated software. So this is kind of like, that's how it's happened in the past, few decades. There's something called the Moore's Law, which says that it's based on what happened in practice. And the Moore's Law says ever since computers have shown on the market, the speed of the computers have doubled each year. So if I don't know. So you have on that graph, you can see the different processors that people manufactured in 1970 through 2005, and they doubled their speed. And the reason why the graph you see is a line is because it's on a log scale. So on the Y scale is not a linear scale. It's multiplied by 10, basically. Every unit is multiplied by 10, which means that this growth is actually exponential. So if you were to plot it in a different way, it wouldn't fit on the... It would grow way too fast, so you wouldn't be able to see it. So that this graph says that if the speed here was like 1,000... well, how many transistors, right? The transistors kind of are proportional to the speed of the computer. Now there's a billion transistors. So the idea is that you can't grow like this for infinity because the speed of light is limited, and so there's only these speeds have grown and grown and grown really fast, but they kind of stopped at this point because they kind of reached that limit. And so if you do the math with the speed of light, which is light travels kind of approximately 1 foot in a nanosecond, which is 10 to the minus ninth of a second, kind of 1/1 billion. We kind of reach that limit. To make it faster, we would have to make things so small that we can't see them. So because we can only make things, that there's a limit of that, we kind of reach that limit at this point. But we still need faster and faster computers because our applications are more and more complex. So, what can we do? And one idea is to make things faster by putting a lot of computers to work. So basically, the idea of a job, if you have a job and you have a lot of hands, the job gets done more quickly. And that's the whole idea of the parallel computers. And I'm going to try to explain to you what are some challenges of this problem, of making it happen, and what are some problems where this is a really, really good idea. And so this is a very funny, fact that in 1989, there was this huge computer, very cool. You can see it in the back in the picture. It was black. It's kind of cool. This computer had 65,000 something processors, so 65,000 brains working in at the same time. And they could do 3.1 billion operations per second. But now in... Mac from a few years ago was able to do 2.5 billion cycles per second. So 2.5 billion operations per second. So what that huge computer did was able to do, working very, very hard with 65,000 processors at the same time, now only one processor can do, and it's available to everybody. I don't have the how expensive that computer in 1989 was, but it was pretty expensive. So it was pretty, it was a breakthrough. So that's how fast things evolve. Also, that's the idea that Google uses. Google, they don't have extremely powerful computers or, super great algorithms. They might do, but they just have tons and tons and tons of computers that work at the same time, and that's how they make things really fast. They don't want to give the exact numbers. But based on the financial information that they release, it's about 300,000. Some people say that it's about 300,000 computers working at the same time, but it's probably more like 100,000. And the whole genius of Google is how to put those computers to work together at the same time and being efficient and fast. So... one problem, does this work for all the problems, right? Well, one example that kind of shows that this would probably not work in all cases is, let's say that, the Harry Potter book, right? One person took 2 years to write it. Can the publisher say, we're just going to hire 600 people to do it at the same time, and they're going to come up with Harry Potter. That would not work, right? Because the whole story is in her brain, and she needs to write it. It wouldn't make any sense if 600 people were sitting in a room and all writing at the same time, because, you know, that wouldn't work in that case. So this is a very sequential task. This is one example of a task that cannot be split between multiple people. So this is one type of problem where this wouldn't work. Another problem is that different processors have different speeds, and the idea that, so the processors, these are two processors and a memory. Memory is very, very slow. Processors are very, very fast. So when processors access memory, it takes a long time. Processor has to wait for memory to be accessed, right? So it's not that the processors aren't fast enough, it's that the memory is slow. And so having more processors doesn't solve the problem that they all have to wait for memory. Another problem is, what happens when two processors try to change something at the same time? Like, what if a flight website, when you buy your flight tickets, they wouldn't be careful, and two people would book the same exact ticket at the same time? That would not be good, right? So you have all these, they're called race conditions, right? You have to make sure that you kind of reserve. When one person comes and books the flight, you know, everybody else can't touch those seats, right? And another problem is that different processors have different speeds. And so if a processor is slower, the other processors have to wait for it. And if you have one slow processor, that's going to make the whole thing slower, right? Everything's going to work at the speed of the slowest brain, right? So, but it turns out that there's an amazing, incredible amount of problems where the parallel, you know, making things in parallel actually works really well. And there are algorithms like that for processing images, for playing chess. You can sum up the number in the list, all the numbers in the list in a parallel fashion, and I'm going to show you how. So there are a lot and lots and lots of problems where this is actually a good idea, and that's why we're talking about it. And most of the applications today are based on how can we break this down to split it between a whole bunch of processors that can solve the problem at the same time. So we'll take an example in the real world, and let's say our job is to paint a fence. So the different parts of this job are, you have to open the paint cans, you have to prepare the surfaces, you have to apply the paint, and you have to clean the brushes. So those are the four sub-jobs of painting a fence. Now, how would you, if you had 20 people that would come and help you, how would you split the work between them? There's at least two ways that I can think of, but, you know, why don't you guys try to come up with them? Like, how would you do it? Any solution works. You have to be a manager. It's not computer science. You don't have an excuse not to tell me how you do it. You guys, anybody can do this test. Anybody else? Sorry. Is this like really hard, or is it just that you don't want to tell me? You just like, it's easier to sleep? All right. Yeah, thank you.
Material in their own little section. Yeah, we can look. wait for them all to finish, and then they can all negotiate their own projects.
So are you saying that you're splitting the fence in 20, and then you give each person A has this part of the fence, person B has this part of the fence, person C has this, and they all, like, they're responsible for that part of the fence, and they're doing all the jobs on that part of the fence. Very good. Okay. That's a good solution. Yeah.
You're actually letting me answer this. I thought you were doing first.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't need to open the paint cans at the same time as the cleaning brushes. So you have two people in the cans, two people in the repair service, 16 people apply the paint, and then when you're done doing that,
okay, very good. Or you could just imagine they have a big enough amount of brushes, they can parallelize three and four too. Yeah, so the other idea is to say, okay, this person is going to be really good at opening the cans, and this other person is going to be really good at preparing the surfaces, and the rest of the people I'm going to use for painting. So you make teams of, you know, the opening can team, the preparing the surfaces team, and so on. Okay? And those were, any other ideas? Those were the two solutions that I thought about too. So this is the, actually, solution number two that we talked about. This is assigning one task per group of people. So each person is going to be responsible with one task. So, you know, first group will open the cans, the second group will prepare the surfaces, the third group will apply the paint, and the fourth group will clean up. Another idea is to, everybody's good at everything. So you just assign fence to this part of the fence to this person, this part of the fence to this person, and so on. Each person gets a part of the fence, and they're completely responsible with it. So this is kind of how things work in computer science, too, with parallel processors. The first kind is called instruction parallelism. So different instructions are executed by different processors. This processor gets to open files. This processor gets to do math. This processor gets to do something else. And they each execute their task on the same data at the same time. The second kind is called data parallelism. So it's parallel from the point of view of the data. You take the data and you split it between all the processors, and each processor does the whole computation on their side of the data, their part of the data. And this is actually what Google uses. That's how Google works. When you give it a search or a query, every processor, every computer does the same query on a different part of the index of words, right? You have a dictionary of words. And for each word, you have the web pages that contain that word. Each processor gets a different part of that list. So let's make an experiment. Everybody has to think of their phone number and raise your hand if your phone number has two fives in it. Alright. So raise your hand. I want to count with you guys. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 people. Okay, that took me, okay, so one, how could I solve this problem? Let's say I need this to know for my research. You know, how many people in my class have a phone number that has two digits, two fives in it? What one thing that I could do would be to ask each one of you to email me your phone number. And then I could go through the list of phone numbers and see, okay, does this number contain two fives? No. Does this number contain two fives? Yes. Check. Does this number contain two fives? And so on. That would take me a long time. Or I could just ask you guys, and each person who has, you know, you guys each do your computation on your own phone number. You each think about your own phone number, and then you give me the answer. And then all I have to do is just count the answer. So this is the whole idea of a query, how a query can be done. So again, the sequential approach, the approach that we've seen so far has been: give me a list of numbers. Remember the list that we used, you know, tons and tons and tons of numbers. Check each number to see if it has two fives in it. And that's a big O of N, right? So I have to go through the whole list and check that for every number. The parallel approach is I assign the task to you guys. You're each one of the processors, and you have a little bit of data, which is your phone number. And you each do your computation on your own phone number, which is going to take a little bit of time. And then you just raise your hand, and I just count how many people have answered it. And it's basically almost constant, right? It's actually log n, but we're going to see why. This is another, how can we do this in Scratch? And I'm going to show you a little Scratch program. See if this works. All right, so this is a whole bunch of cats, and each cat has a costume, and the costume can be orange like the classical cat or green like the non-classical cat, like this cat right here. And if I click on the cat switches its costume. If it's an orange cat, it's going to become a green cat, and if it's a green cat, it's going to become an orange cat. So what I can do, there's a list of costume here too. The sequential approach is saying when S key press, so when I'm going to press the S key, what's happening is it's going through, so green count is how many cats are green. And it starts by being 0, and then, let me make this smaller for now, it's going through the list of costumes, and whenever it sees a costume that is 2, which means a green costume, it changes green count by 1. So at this point, for some reason these are 2. I'm gonna change them. Alright, so everybody has a yellow costume. And when I press S, it's counting the green and gives me 0. If I click on one of the cats, let's click on 2 of them. Two cats have costume. Have a green costume, and that didn't work. And it's counting them to be 2. But what it's doing, it's doing a sequential thing. It's going through a whole list. Now, if I click on one of the cats, each cat is running the following code. When I click on it, it changes the costume, and then if I do the operation in parallel, I basically broadcast green check for each cat. So this is like telling you guys, think of your phone number, and if it has 2 5s in it, raise your hand. So when the cat receives that request, what it's doing is checking its own costume. If my costume number is 2, then I'm going to change the green count by 1. So I'm actually going and adding 1 to a variable. So again, there's the sequential way, the way where it's going systematically through a list and checking all the cats, or there's the way where the cats actually tell the user, I'm a green cat and you have to add me to your list of green cats. All right, I think we're gonna pick up from here next time. So, I'm going to end early.